Let's not talk about this. Everyone's already switched off. If you're new to PaleoCast, this isn't it. We've actually got a fantastic episode with Graham Young, who's a creator. He's creator of Manitoba Museum in Canada. He made it all himself. If you're new to PaleoCast, this is what it's like. It's just me messing up. Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name's Dave Marshall and today I'm joined by Joe Keating.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. It's been a long time. It's been about 6 days.
Yeah, since Progressive Paleontology. Eventful conference.
Eventful drive home.
But yeah, some good talks. It was nice to see, 300% increase in early vertebrate workers. So that's good.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah. Step in the right direction.
Is it?
Probably. Yes. One of them was me and one of them was my student. So it doesn't really count.
I'm just trying to think how many arthropod talks were there.
I don't think there was any.
I don't think there were any. Oh, I was so busy trying to nurse the live stream and try and troubleshoot it that I just really didn't pay much attention to any of the talks, which was a real shame.
But from mine, obviously.
Apart from yours, which I gave my full undivided attention. But I've got them all recorded anyway, so I'll be able to watch them all back at my own leisure, as hopefully everyone else will be able to.
It's been a while since we've recorded one of these intros.
Yeah, it must have been months because I've been away working on the rigs for, it must have been 5 months almost. Like, you can only work 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off at a time, but I've been doing that for, yeah, since January. So I'm only just getting back on my feet with my life, really. Just getting all my stuff together.
Big changes, I hear. Move down to Bristol.
Well, not moved yet, but possibly a PhD at Bristol is on the cards. So I'll be coming to see you.
Very exciting.
We'll be living next door.
Like old times.
Oh, dear. We'll be on the naughty step in Bristol.
I've saved you a spot. So who are you talking to today, Dave?
So I managed to get an interview with Graham Young, who's curator at Manitoba Museum in Canada, and we're going to be talking about the Medusae.
Oh, and what are they?
It's basically jellyfish, but it's not quite as simple as that. I was on a little voyage of discovery myself with this one. They're not quite as simple as most animals that we're all familiar with. They've got a very peculiar life cycle.
Ah, I look forward to hearing about it.
So this episode is the first of two parts. So if you're listening on our website, don't forget to scroll down and listen to the second piece.
As always, we'll have lots of fantastic images for you to check out. And if you'd like to leave us a Facebook message or comment, we'd be happy to receive them.
Well, Graham, thank you very much for joining us. As is always the case with new PaleoCast interviewees, could you first give us an introduction to yourself and tell us how you became a paleontologist?
Well, I'm Graham Young. I'm curator of geology and paleontology at the Manitoba Museum in Winnipeg, which is pretty much right in the center of North America. Considering how I became a paleontologist, I grew up in a place where there were very few fossils to find, or at least I didn't know how to find them, which was in the middle of New Brunswick on the east coast of Canada. But I was very lucky that my father was an academic and had a good connection to England, so that we spent a couple of sabbatical leaves in London when I was a kid. And of course, I spent a lot of time at the Natural History Museum and became very addicted to the fossils there. And we also went fossil hunting on the Bristol Channel and looking for ammonoids. So I think that's how I got onto it. And I thought, if this is something someone could do for a living, I'm all for that.
So was your father a paleontologist himself?
No, he's a historian.
Well, it's near enough.
Oh, yeah.
We just look at a lot further back in time.
That's right. It's just a different sort of history.
And so when did you actually become a paleontologist? What was your route into it?
I thought it was something I wanted to do. We didn't have a paleobiology program at any of our local universities. So I actually went through, I did an honors undergraduate in biology, but it was a university that had both biology and geology in the sciences and had some very good profs in both. So I was able to take some of the soft rock and paleo courses. And then I guess I really switched over to being a paleontologist. Well, I did a thesis on tabula corals in my fourth year, and then got on to trilobites and did a master's at University of Toronto with Rolf Ludvigsen, who I think is known to a lot of people as a very well-known, very productive trilobite worker. I did a master's with Rolf. I flip-flopped back to corals for a PhD back in New Brunswick, and then was very fortunate to receive some federal government funding. I got a postdoc, an NSERC postdoc, to go and work on corals with Colin Scruton at Newcastle, and we did some work particularly on Silurian tabulates from Gotland. And then I jumped back to Canada again. I was looking around. I'm old enough that we didn't yet have email. The internet was not something that most of us, yeah, that may surprise you. the internet was not something that was available to most of us. So I wrote letters to paleontologists I knew and posted them off. And very fortunately, Dr. Bob Elias at University of Manitoba in Winnipeg wrote back and said, I can offer you a year of funding, and this is the project on Ordovician corals from the East Central United States. And Bob very graciously actually funded me as a postdoc out of his research funds for about 3 years. So I think I was very fortunate. I was one of those people who managed to stay in the system until a position opened up, which was a position at the museum in Winnipeg. And I guess I was sort of Johnny on the spot. It was a very tight time for budgets in Canada. The museum said, we can offer you 2 days a week for 10 months. And I've been there over 20 years now. So
doing 2 days a week?
No. Very, very, very fortunately, I got my foot in the door and sort of levered the rest of myself in and made myself useful. And the museum decided they would keep me around. And I got made full time and then permanent. And I've been I've been the senior curatorial person in the place for quite a while now, because I came in at the end of all the people who'd been hired in the 70s, and I was hired in the 90s, and then there was something of a gap, and so I've gone from being a junior 2 day a week person to having been the senior professional curator in the place for quite a while. So I guess the moral of all this is you just have to find a way to keep yourself in the system if you really want to do it.
What do you actually do as a curator? What does that involve in your day-to-day routine?
Well, at our museum, and as with most museums in Canada, and I suspect North America, a curator is not a collections manager. I think some museums in Britain, they have people called curators who are the people who take care of the collections. So we actually, fortunately, have some very good collections staff who handle a lot of the issues with specimens and especially cataloging and databasing. I deal with all of the acquisitions. So I have to determine what is appropriate for the collections, whether it's a donation or by field collection. I do research whenever the time permits. At a museum the size of ours, which has three curators in the natural sciences, and then another few curators in historical disciplines. We don't necessarily always have that much time for research because we also do the exhibits for the museum. Okay. I find it a fascinating job. I think it's something great that it keeps me on my toes because I'm, in a way, of course, it'd be lovely to do research all the time, but I think it's tremendously stimulating to have to deal with other aspects of earth sciences, I have to answer questions from the public, I create exhibits, so I think it's a more creative job in some ways.
So today we're going to be talking about some of your research into the Medusae. So can you first tell us what they are?
Well, Medusae is the scientific term for what most people know as jellyfish. And not everything that people call jellyfish are Medusae, but the great majority of them are things we would call Medusae. And Medusae are a free-moving portion of within the life cycle of cnidarians. So of this particular phylum, which also contains well-known things like the corals and sea anemones.
And so what characteristics do the Medusae have that unite them all together?
Well, the main characteristic is, as I mentioned, that they are free swimming things. They are things that have generally, it's very hard to make very broad generalizations because there will be things that are incorrect whenever I say it. And I know there are many gaps in my knowledge of the extant forms as well. But they're generally things that have been produced asexually. So they've been produced by budding from a form that lived usually attached to the seafloor. And they are generally things that swim around freely. They are generally the sexual form that produces gametes, produces sex cells that then produces offspring by sexual means. They very broadly have a symmetry that could be called radial, although some of them do have some bilateral symmetry. Some of them are divided. Many of them have a quadrate symmetry as well, but broadly radial symmetry. They have stinging cells, I think all of them. I'll probably make a mistake here. They generally have tentacles. Those that don't have tentacles may have very large oral arms, which are tentacle-like structures that arise from a different part of the body. So they're united by those features. They don't really have a brain. Some of them do have a reasonably sophisticated nervous system.
Oh, this really surprised me about the reproduction. My next question was going to be on their ecology. So I've never really thought of a medusoid?
Yes.
Is that the single?
Medusoid is anything that looks like a medusa in the fossil record.
Right, okay.
So a medusoid is not necessarily a medusa.
So a medusa is the singular.
Yes.
Right. So I've never really thought of a medusa as being... Sorry, I lost where I was going with that.
As swimming around and reproducing.
No, I never thought of... Well, the asexual one.
Yeah.
They sexually produce, but the sexually produce, they're benthic, they live on the seafloor?
Sorry, the forms that live on the seafloor and... The easiest ones to imagine are the hydroid colonies. Many people have seen hydroids, and most hydroids produce a medusan stage, which is a hydromedusan, which are little jellyfish. And those little jellyfish will have gonads, and typically you have males and females that look a little bit different. And the gonads often make up quite a big part of the jellyfish. So that sexual reproduction is obviously pretty important to jellyfish.
Mm-hmm. This really came out of left field for me. I didn't read up enough about their ecology, to be honest.
Well, and as I say, you're going to be getting me out of my depth pretty quickly because I mostly think about what we can see in fossils, which in some cases is gonads, but of course I'm not able to tell, or we have not been able to recognize males and females, and we don't see the other parts of the life cycle. So as with many other fossils, we tend to limit our thinking to the parts that we as paleontologists see.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that in a bit. So, but are they really quite unlike anything else? Do any other animals have this kind of reproductive lifestyle?
I don't know. There aren't any other animals that produce things that we would call medusae. There are other jelly-like creatures in the sea. The best known would be the ctenophores or comb jellies, which are a completely different phylum, but many people in common parlance will call those jellyfish. There are also things like the Portuguese man of war, which is a structure that, which is a the other part of a hydrozoan life cycle. So I guess the answer is there are many other jelly-like things that people, that if people saw them on the beach, they would say that's a jellyfish. But some of those are the other parts of hydrozoan life cycles, and some of those are not cnidarians at all. They belong to other phyla. But the things that look at all like classical jellyfish, if you imagine the moon jelly, mm-hmm. anything that looks pretty much like that, or that sort, general sort of creature, those are, I think we could call all of those medusae, and those are all cnidarian medusae.
Okay. So do they have a quite large distribution? If you've got any kind of sea or ocean, are you likely to find jellyfish in them?
I think, now again, I'm going to, these are very big questions. They have tremendously broad distribution. They have tremendous abundance. I've certainly seen them in many seas and oceans. I've read about them in many others. Of course, as humans, we'll tend to be familiar with the ones that are along shorelines or in coastal waters. And certainly, coastal waters may have some of the greatest abundances, but there are many forms that are far out in the sea, and there are deep sea forms as well, which I think in many cases are still being described, and that's really where the diversity is not so well understood. So yeah, I think it's a group that is not hugely diverse, and I suspect you'll get to diversity. It's not very diverse compared to most other groups of invertebrates, but the numbers per species must be among the highest in some taxa, because they really are phenomenal. If you imagine these things occupying a three-dimensional space, and some of the genera are worldwide, of course, and some species occur in many parts of the world. So the numbers have to be pretty much unimaginable.
Okay, and so without brains as such, what do they eat? Are they just kind of passive feeders?
Well, they eat different things. Different ones eat very different things. As in any successful group, I think you will find that the different creatures have different approaches. There are ones that have symbiotic bacteria, I guess, but certainly that have symbionts that photosynthesize and produce energy for them. And of course, those ones don't have to do very much. There are other ones like the moon jellies that apparently float around and are largely pretty much passive feeders. There are other, there are some of the big scyphozoans, the classic jellyfish, seem to eat quite a few fish. There are others among that group that actually eat other jellyfish. And then there are things like the cubozoans, the box jellies, that are really very active predators. And they're unusual among jellyfish in that they can perceive prey and move towards their prey. So they're the least passive.
So how would a jellyfish see its prey? Do they have any eyes or a way of detecting movement?
Quite a lot of them have eye structures of varying degrees of complexity. Many of them are, of course, very simple, but the cubozoans have been picked out for a lot of study in the past couple of decades. It's very interesting. I've been reading up on literature on this group. And if you look back to the 1960s, there will be statements, you know, these are among the most primitive of jellyfish. And, you know, they're very simple, primitive things. Well, clearly they were thought to be primitive because they were poorly known, because it's become appreciated as people have studied them in more detail that they're more sophisticated than any of the rest in their behavior. They actually have very highly evolved eyes. They have very well developed eyes. They can see quite well, and these eyes are arranged. They're within the sensory structures, and there are four sensory structures around the outside of the box jellyfish. So they can actually see their prey, and then they can propel themselves towards it.
We're gonna have to get some pictures of these. I'm gonna have to do some digging.
Yeah. Well, look up the box jellies. There are a lot of fantastic photographs of them coming out. They're really, you know, when we think about aliens, of alien life forms of one sort or another, you know, these are among the most alien things on our planet. And I think the people who are doing behavioral studies on them, and again, a lot of this is really recent, a lot in the last 4 or 5 years, they're finding that these things are remarkably sophisticated.
Okay, so the cubozoa are the box.
Yes.
Cube box.
They're the box jellies. They're the ones you keep hearing about in Australia with people unfortunately being killed by them periodically.
Mm-hmm. And which are the other subgroups?
The other big subgroups, so nowadays they will talk about the cubozoa or cubomedusae, so that's one big subgroup. The other two big subgroups on that scale are the scyphozoa and the hydrozoa.
So the scyphozoa, were they the true jellyfish?
Yes, the scyphozoa are the true jellyfish, or the classic jellyfish. And these would include things like the moon jelly, the compass jelly, the lion's mane jellyfish.
So the ones that we'd be more familiar with, I guess.
Yeah, the ones that are, many of them are quite big. They're very visible. They may be very abundant in certain seasons of the year on particular shorelines. So they're very familiar to people. Some of them are quite tough as well. And I know we'll get onto the fossilization, but some of the scyphozoans are quite robust, and therefore they may last for a while on shorelines. So they may sit there long enough for people to walk along and accidentally step on them, for instance.
Mm-hmm. And the hydrozoa was the other one?
Yes, and the hydrozoa are actually the most diverse. There are many forms. Many of them are very small. Many of them are in the range of a centimeter across, or maybe a couple of centimeters. The big ones may be up to quite a few centimeters across, so up to certainly the same sort of size as the moon jelly, and some of those are reasonably robust. The big hydromedusans, one of the ones that people may be more familiar with is Aquaria, or the crystal jellyfish, which is found on quite a few coasts.
Okay. And then outside the Medusae, the closest relatives you said were corals and anemones.
Yes. And of course, the non-Medusan life cycle of the hydroids is another thing that's very well known. Many people have studied the hydra in biology classes, and there are many colonial hydroids which can form quite large structures. And among those, one of the better known ones would be Millepora, or the fire coral.
Okay, and what's the difference mainly between the corals and the anemones from the things like the Medusae? Is it just that they can produce secrete a skeleton? The corals,
yes, at least. And the other big difference with the corals is that they don't have a medusan in their life cycle,
right?
So corals have sex among themselves and produce a larva that way. So they've left the medusan out, and I think that there's been question about did in fact the common ancestor have a medusan that the corals have lost, or did the common ancestor uh, not not have a Medusan stage, and then it got added, and therefore that's a feature that all the Medusozoa, which, you know, are the Cubozoa, Scyphozoa, Hydrozoa, would share. So I think that's the more, from my reading of it, that's the more commonly held opinion now, is that that is a feature that was added, that portion of the life cycle, and therefore that's something that separates all of them from the corals and the anemones.
Okay, so I hope that's given everyone a good enough introduction to Medusae.
And to any biologists who are listening, I hope I haven't made any egregious errors about any of these things.
Send all your corrections in to Graham, right. Not me.
Don't you have a discussion page?
We do, yeah. So excellent. Please write them on there. You're doing my job for me. I'm the one that's supposed to be telling everyone about that. Anyway, so if we have a look at the Medusae in the fossil record now, we always try and remind people that it's only ever the hard parts of animals that get preserved in normal circumstances. And so how is it that we can get these entirely soft-bodied organisms to be preserved?
That is a very, very good question.
So that's the end of the first part of our episode on Medusae. Stay tuned for part two.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Cnidarians. Cnidaria?
Cnidarians.
Cnidaria.